we're doing, to catch up everybody, what we're doing is we're trying to explore the nature of the communications which courts have described as constituting a, quote, meeting of the minds or mutual assent. We started out with trying to define what an offer is and what components of an offer are. We're not finished with that by any means, but we've started. And now we're going to work on the question of, well, what is an acceptance? Since the theory is that we can make a contract by having an offer and an acceptance of the offer. And so let's start by looking at Ardent versus Horan, which is the case on page 430. And Ms. Schubert, my question for you is, how could this lawyer who was representing the buyers here have worded their client's desires in a way which would not have, as it did here, resulted in the court saying, oh, this was not an acceptance? What could that communication have said other than what they said? What they said, of course, is that indented paragraph on page 430. My clients are concerned that the following items remain with the real estate. A, dining room set and tapestry wall covering the dining room. B, fireplace fixtures throughout. C, the sun parlor furniture. I would appreciate your confirming that these items are a part of the transaction, as they would be difficult to replace. The court looks at it and says, that's not an acceptance.
Well, could he have worded it more of a request?
Do it.
Okay. More of a request, because this to me means like, I'll buy it under this condition. Like, these have to be part of it. If he had written it or made it more form of request, or even if I really want these, you know, please consider this as part of the deal. And or you can also say something like a consideration. I would, you know, additional consideration on the buyer's part, saying if you throw these in, I'll give you X amount of dollars. So maybe two different ways you could have done that.
Well, of course, the issue is not palatable here, right? I mean, the issue is we're trying to preserve for discussion in some fashion or another whether these items will be left or not. But on the other hand, we want to do it in a way which doesn't prevent this from becoming an acceptance. Because what's the consequence if it's not an acceptance? What is it?
Counteroffer.
And if it's a counteroffer, what happens to the original offer?
It's not valid.
It's dead, right? We've killed the offer by making a counteroffer. Or at least, maybe we have. That's for discussion, but at least this court says that that's the effect of a counteroffer. So we don't want it to be a counteroffer, but we do want it to communicate to the seller that our clients would like to have these items that are listed in this letter. So this court comes along and says they create, or they quote Williston as having described, something which is called a conditional acceptance. So what's a conditional acceptance? Conditional acceptance is not a counteroffer. So what is a conditional acceptance? What does it do as a matter of law? If we've successfully done something, if the court had looked at this and said, aha, we know what this is a conditional acceptance, what would the result have been?
Then it would have been a contract then, because they did accept it with an added.
Okay, would have been, and then what happens to this, the rest of it? The tapestries and the furniture and the fireplace tools? What's their status?
Then it probably would have went with the, or no. If it's conditional and they said, I accept this based on, with this stuff thrown in, is that what you're saying?
No. If it's an acceptance, that can't be right, right? Because you can only accept an offer, and were those things part of the offer?
No.
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 So my question is, if we'll study how we can do this, but if we successfully made this a conditional acceptance, this court says, hey, this was not a conditional acceptance. If it had been a conditional acceptance, it would have been an acceptance. Well, if it's an acceptance, what happens to those other things? What status do they have? Any?
No, because I'm accepting it, but it's not making it a make it or break it contract at that point.
Or it doesn't make them part of the contract, so does it have no status at all?
Well, I guess, you know, the sellers could say, yeah, I'll throw it in or not.
Or if the sellers could say that, how are we characterizing this additional material of tapestries and what in contract terms, what are those now? You said they could be accepted by the seller, so they must be, what do you accept?
The conditions.
You accept?
The offer.
Offers. You accept offers. So maybe what the court is saying, or what Williston is saying and the court agrees with, is, well, you can word it in a way which represents an acceptance of the seller's offer of sale, and this other material that makes it a condition as opposed to simply an acceptance, now it's a conditional acceptance, it leaves it as an acceptance of the seller's offer, but these things which are quote conditions, they are really offers. And we would say, if you think back to the material we talked about in the fall term, if we already have a contract and somebody wants to make a change in it, what's that called?
A modification.
A modification. Exactly. So this represents an offer to modify. So the court says, if you worded it so that we would look at it and say, oh yeah, we know what this is. This is a conditional acceptance. What we would have had is we would have had an acceptance of the offer, which means there's a contract. And we would have had a suggestion of, or let's put the word in as an offer of, the part of the buyers, in this case, to buy these other items. That was an offer to modify the contract, which you're quite correct. The seller could say, oh, sure, I'll do that for $1,000 more. Or, yes, I'll do it. Then we'd have to worry about consideration for the modification, which we would also need if it were not a sale of goods. Well, how do I know which is a conditional acceptance and which is a counteroffer if the character of the acceptance is that it has language like, my clients are concerned? How about if it said, my clients would like the following items to remain? Would that have made it a conditional acceptance?
I would say more so than, you know, confirming it, because the way they originally worded it was more of a, this, I will accept based on these terms. If you word it the way you just said it, then it's more of a request rather than.
Right. How did the court interpret the language used by their attorney, the buyer's attorney? I mean, I read you the language, my clients are concerned with the following items. How does that really being interpreted by the court? I'm going mostly on the basis of the court saying, oh yeah, this was not a conditional acceptance. Doesn't meet our criteria of conditional acceptance, by which they mean an acceptance which is coupled with an expression of desire for some modification. That's how the court interprets that, and that's how Williston interpreted it. So that brings me back to my first question. I mean, well, how do we say that in this case? How should the lawyer have written this if the goal, and we don't know what their goal was, right? But if the goal was that they really wanted to buy the house, whether this stuff was there or not, how should this have been worded? They still wanted to mention it, right? They didn't want to just sign what the seller had sent them, the seller's draft of the contract. They didn't want to just sign it and send it back. So they wanted to have this other stuff mentioned, They told their lawyer to mention it. So how should the lawyer have mentioned it? Suppose they say that, said to the lawyer, look, we want the place anyway, but we would really like it if they left this stuff because it'd be kind of hard to find replacements.
Yeah, I would even use the word request, because in this one they said, my clients are concerned that the following items remain. My clients would like to request the following items be included.
Let's start with that. What if they had said that? The old letter says is, my clients would like to see included the following items. Would that have been an acceptance?
Well, I don't know. That still, I think, might lean towards how the court ruled, because my clients would like to include.
What in fact did they do along with this letter? What else did they send? It was a letter with what else?
A check for $20,000.
Yeah, and good. One other document.
Signed.
The signed agreement.
Yeah.
They signed the contract. They signed the contract. What do you think the lawyer thought here? They signed the contract. They include a check as called for by the contract. And then there's a letter which says, my clients are concerned that these remain. If you were the lawyer, what would you have thought you had just done?
I think maybe make a separate offer for the furniture almost.
You would have thought that they had made a deal. Made a deal with an expression that you'd really like it if the sellers would leave these items. But the court didn't interpret it that way. And so the problem is, well, if we just say, well, my clients would like these things included, is that enough? Or does that make it sound also as though they're saying, we're not really accepting it? Even though we signed it, even though we sent you a check, nevertheless, it's not an acceptance. Does this decision seem a little harsh to you? Or more, let me ask the question differently. Is the interpretation by the court correct? If we take a look again at Williston's language, frequently an offeree, while making a positive acceptance of the offer, also makes a request or suggestion that some addition or modification be made. So long as it is clear that the meaning of the acceptance is positively and unequivocally to accept the offer, whether such request is granted or not, a contract is formed. Now suppose you were their attorney and you were familiar with Williston's description, would you think that what you had written fit within the terms of that description? You think not? Why not, Mr. Diffie?
You don't, because there's no explicit and unequivocal saying, we're accepting this offer. I guess you could read into it because there's a check in that, but it leaves too much doubt, I guess, into that. So if you want to be on the safe side, you'd say no. You'd say,
well, what's the meaning if they're signing the contract?
Well, maybe.
The contract didn't contain this language, right?
Right, so but you could also, maybe this is stress, but you could argue that they signed it, sent the check along to speed up the process, that they'll get back to us on this. If they are going to include it, they'll keep the check. If they're going to include the extra material, they'll keep the check and sign it as well. I mean, it might be a stretch, but.
If the seller had taken the position here that there was a contract and the buyer had refused to go through with it, saying we have no contract because we never accepted it, who do you think would win? Well, you'd wonder about that, wouldn't you? Suppose they'd cashed the check.
Then there's a contract.
And there was a contract. Well, how can there be a contract?
They accepted. They took the money and they put it in there.
That's right. We could always say, well, the buyer made the offer and the seller accepted the offer. No, but wait a second. Then it means they have to include all the stuff?
No, because that's not on the document that they signed.
Oh, but it came along with it. After all, this court tied these two inextricably together, didn't they? Now, it's a little messy. This court obviously wasn't really all that certain that the seller had made an offer. Why not? the seller challenges the question of whether or not, in fact, there was an offer at all. They said, we're going to go along. So we're going to go along because the lower court said there was an offer, but we're not so sure there was an offer. Why not?
The sellers never actually made up the sales agreement. It was actually the other guy who had it.
No, no, the seller did, but you're right in fingering the seller. What did the seller not do? They didn't sign the contract. So they sent this offer, but they never signed it. So the court suggests, well, maybe if you send an offer and you don't sign it, maybe it's not an offer. Maybe one of the requisites of an offer is that it carry a signature. We don't know. We have no idea. And the court really doesn't decide that question, but if you look at footnote 2 on page 431, you'll see the conclusion that the delivery of the agreement was an offer is not unassailable. Isn't that a lovely, unhelpful way of saying it? It's not unassailable. The world's not. It's not unassailable in view of the fact that defendants did not sign the agreement before sending it to the plaintiff, and the fact that plaintiff told defendant's attorney after the agreement was received that he would have to investigate certain conditions of title before signing the agreement. If it was not an offer, the plaintiff's exception of the agreement could itself be no more than an offer, which defendants never accepted. And that's clearly true. If the seller was not the offeror, then the only, if that was an invitation to deal, then of course what the defendant did in signing this document and sending it to the seller, that was the offer, which the seller of course rejected because they sold the property to somebody else. Now, apart from the question of whether or not that would have been a good decision, that is, that this is not an offer, it certainly would have been a more acceptable ground, I think, than the ground of saying, oh no, this was not a conditional acceptance. Now, you could come along and say to Williston, look, this is nonsense. There can't be a conditional acceptance, which is an acceptance. You don't mean that at all. You mean there can be an acceptance with an offer to modify. A suggestion of modification, that's really an offer to modify. And that's clearly true. Would we call it a conditional acceptance? The terminology here is very, very bad, because if it's a conditional acceptance, that means that the condition would have to be satisfied for it to be an acceptance, and that's not what Williston was saying. He was saying the opposite. He was saying, oh well, you can attach to an acceptance a request for modification, and that will not eliminate its character as an acceptance. It's still an acceptance, there's still a contract. What happened to the other language? Well, it's simply an offer to modify, and if the other side doesn't accept it, well, then it goes nowhere. So that would have been, in this case, for example, if the court had decided that was true here, then the seller would have had to sell the property to this buyer, but the seller would not have had to include all this other furniture and tapestry and all this other stuff, because that would not have been part of the seller's offer that had been made into a contract by the buyer's acceptance.
Excuse me, should we infer that this was discussed earlier? Because see, just thinking logically, wouldn't this have been discussed prior to contracts going back and forth and agreements going back and forth?
You'd hope so.
You know, it just seems like, why would this come in out of the blue?
You'd hope so, but you'd be amazed at the things that, the arguments. I have some people who work real estate here, haven't I? I would like, if I had a dollar for every time that a seller decided, oh well, I really like that sconce, or I really like that chandelier, and I think I'll take it. You think they come to their lawyer and say, well, let's see, I'll ask now the real property question, you know, the delightful study next year to look forward to in property. And then the question is, well, let's see, is that a fixture or not? Because under the law of real property, anything that is a, quote, fixture is real estate. But everything that is not a fixture, that's personality, that's not real estate. Most people, when they go to sell a house, have absolutely no idea which parts of the house are fixtures and which are, they think they know, but they don't really know. So you really can't take that sink out, because that's a fixture. The dishwasher is a fixture. The washer and dryer, well, It's hard. The washer is a fixture, but is it a dryer? Well, if it's a gas dryer, it undoubtedly is, but how about if it's an electric dryer? Well, it's plugged in. Well, how about the lamp? The lamp is plugged in. Is that a fixture? No, that's not a fixture. That's personal thing. And so you get this in property. You're going to learn the stuff. You'll love it. It's delightful. I taught property many years ago. So, you know, you have this interesting and peculiar determination of what something is. Is it fixture or not? Now, these particular items that they've described, frankly, I have no idea whether the tapestry wall covering was or was not a fixture. It may have been. How was it put on the wall? If it was cemented to the wall, so that if you tried to pull it down, you'd pull down the wall, or at least a portion of it, then it's a fixture. Therefore, it has to go with the house. It was part of the seller's offer when the seller offers the real estate. On the other hand, I don't care what the Sun Parlor furniture looked like. I don't care how heavy it was. I think that it was, in fact, personal thing. But you can't be absolutely sure of that. There's a rather famous case of eminent domain. Eminent domain means the state or government, some government agency, is taking the property from the private owner because they are taking it for a public purpose. And they have to pay just compensation under the Constitution. But that doesn't mean they can't take it. It only means they have to pay just compensation. So there's one case in which there was a newspaper plant, a place where newspapers actually are printed, and it was being taken by eminent domain. And the question became, how about the presses? Are the presses part of the real estate? The newspaper company wanted them to be counted as part of the real estate because they didn't want to have to move these damn things. And they were building a new facility with more modern presses, so they wanted to be compensated for not only the value of the building and land, but also for the presses. And the government said, no, the presses, after all, are not connected to anything. They just sit on the floor, and therefore they are personalty, they're not realty, and therefore not part of the valuation for purpose of eminent domain. The court wrote an opinion which required the state to compensate for the presses, saying that they were affixed by gravity. So are we. But we're not realty. You can see that sometimes the law is not entirely clear about this question of what's realty and what's a fixture and what's personal thing. In any event, here, some of these items were clearly not fixtures. Others may have been fixtures. And you would hope that the seller and the buyer had talked with each other about which items were fixtures and which ones were not, which ones were going to be left and which ones were not. Apparently, they never had that conversation, or they had it, but it was inconclusive, and when the seller went to have the contract drafted, they didn't talk about any of it. Now, there's a good argument from the standpoint of property law, incidentally, that there should have been a separate contract in any event for these items. But that's not what happened. So we don't really know the backstory here. It's a good question, but we don't really know the answer to this. I would worry about language. My clients are concerned that that was clearly terrible. That didn't work. I'd worry about my clients hope that you intend to leave these. That'd probably be better. My clients would like these and are prepared to pay for them if you're willing to sell them. That's probably even better. One of your suggestions. So we now know that we have to be very conscious of this problem, that if our client needs to tell us, do you really want the deal as it's spelled out in this document that's called an offer? Because if you really want this deal, we have to simply say we accept it. And if there's some things you'd like in addition, we'll talk about those as modifications of the contract, modifications of the agreement, or a separate agreement. If you don't want those things, unless they are included, that's fine. I will make it clear that we are not accepting the offer as such. We would accept an offer if it included these other elements, and that will clearly be a counteroffer. The counteroffer extinguishes the offer. It's now dead. And the only offer on the table is the counteroffer. I still think that the court is wrong, but I leave that for you to decide. The court says, we interpret the letter to impose a condition on plaintiff's acceptance of the defendant's offer. The letter does not unequivocally state that even without the enumerated items, plaintiff is willing to complete the contract. In saying it, the court is ignoring the communicative value of the signature on the contract and the accompanying check. That, I think, is wrong. It may be the lawyer's fault. It may be that the lawyer tried to argue the language itself. And I can imagine that happening because I can imagine the lawyer not wanting to acknowledge the possibility that they screwed up in the way in which they articulated their client's, quote, concern, unquote. But they should have thrown it all. It should have thought, the presentation by the buyer's attorney should have been, Your Honor, you have to look at the entire communication, which includes a signed contract and a check, in addition to the language that I used in the letter, expressing my client's hope that these items would be left. Anyway, you notice that in Rhode Island Department of Transportation, this is the same court. This is the Rhode Island court. 20 years later, this Arden versus Rand is 1976, this is now 1996. It's the same court, that is the Supreme Court of Rhode Island. And here, even though the quote acceptance said, of course you understand that certain wording in the real estate sales agreement relating to buyer and obligations concerning the removal of track would be inappropriate to the purpose of the state's purchase. Boy, that sounds like an absolute total rejection of language. But the court says, well, no, not really. We think the state really did accept. Now, there are public policy motivations here, probably. But I love the reasoning. The reasoning is, well, after all, this is for the good of the party of the offeror. And since it's for the good of the offeror, it's not a counteroffer. Well, that doesn't parse. Right, that's a wholly illogical statement. The law is, if there's a difference, it's not an acceptance. So you can make of that what you want. What you need to make of it is that you've got to be really, really, really careful, because courts will take what you say quite seriously in an effort to try to figure out whether it constitutes an acceptance or not. Now, you know, as is true of all contractual undertakings, in most cases, this never would have happened. What would have happened here is the seller would have called up and said, yeah, we're going to leave the tapestry, but we're going to take the furniture. They would not have thought to have rejected it. Why did they? Another buyer came along and they decided to sell it to the other buyer. See, that's the risks one takes. As for the notion, by the way, that the offer has to be signed, I don't know of any courts that have ever said that. And it's fairly typical in real estate transactions for the seller not to sign the offer. Fairly typical. Okay. So what can you say and what you can't say? Well, you look at the price. I always point this letter out to my colleagues when you go to object to the contract letter that the college sends to all faculty members during March for their contract, and usually they have something to say in protest against whatever the salary offer is. Very important that if you really want your job, you sign it and then say anything else you want to say underneath the signature rather than before the signature. If it's underneath the signature, the court will usually do what this court did. That raises a fascinating question with Ardent versus Horan, doesn't it? If they had written what they had written, not in a separate letter, but had written it immediately under the signature on the contract, what would the court have said then? Well, we don't know. We simply do not know. The note on the mirror image rule tells you that the classic view, and we're going to see how the law is gradually evolving away from this, the classic view about offers and acceptances is that they have to be, quote, mirror image. That is, they have to be identical. Mirror image is really not the right way of saying it. They have to be identical. That's why when I first described offer, I said it really has to be in a form in which the offeree can simply say yes, because there's no better way of providing an identical, an acceptance that's identical to the offer than saying yes. If you say anything other than yes, you have to look closely at the question of whether or not you are, in fact, accepting when you understand that the acceptance has to be identical to the offer under the traditional view. We're moving away slightly from that, and we're going to, a little later, we're going to talk about a provision called 2207 in the Uniform Commercial Code, which tries to do a little better than that, to broaden out the rules of the game a little bit. It's unsuccessful, but it's an effort. And you've looked at Livingston versus Evanston, Colt versus Christie, you got a pretty good idea of the variations. So now we know, what do we know? We know what an offer is, or at least we sort of do. It has to contain enough information about the character of the deal so that simply saying yes would describe to the court, as well as to the parties, what the overall arrangement is. Usually that means it should contain price, it should contain a description of whatever it is the subject, it should contain the amount of the goods, if they're goods. It is helpful if it says when, but it doesn't have to. The court is willing to fill that gap, as we'll learn. Anyway, so now we have an offer. And we know that there are various ways in which offers can cease to exist. One we just looked at is if there's a counteroffer. So this is the offeror, remember, I'm over on the offeree side. If there's a counteroffer. We also learned, of course, from those gentlemen who offered to resign in order for them to be taken seriously, that it can expire from what I like to call old age. That is, that every offer has somehow or another some length of life, some natural life, and when it reaches the end of the natural life, it ceases to be available for acceptance. Very unclear what that is. It's a very contextual question. So that we looked at the one case in which the court says, well, the context was it was in a face-to-face conversation, and we think from that context we conclude that at the end of the face-to-face conversation, the offer died. But lots of times, of course, these are not done in that form. Sometimes parties are provide the court with some help. They will say, for example, that this offer is available for 10 days. Or 1 month, or 6 months, or a year. Now, there's nothing about that that makes it contractually binding on the offeror to leave it available for that period of time, but it will have the effect of it not expiring within that period of time. So if I say, this offer is good for 10 days, it comes to the fifth day, I can communicate a revocation of the offer to the offeree, and the offer is no more. It's not an assurance. On the other hand, if I say nothing to the offeree, and the offeree comes along on the eighth day or the ninth day and accepts the offer, and I say, oh, no, the offer is expired from old age. You should have done it within 24 hours or 48 hours. the court's going to say, no, you said 10 days, and therefore it's not going to expire until 10 days. So it can expire from old age, and we have to figure out what old age would mean. And implicit in Arden versus Horan, of course, is this one, that is, if there's been a rejection, because after all, the reason the counteroffer extinguished the offer is that it really is a rejection of the offer and a making of a new offer. So a rejection alone also terminates the offer. So we have all these various ways in which offers can die. What is it that makes a contract? It is, of course, an acceptance. And the acceptance makes the offer irrevocable now because it is now a contract. Now, there's another way, which we said last class, of making that offer irrevocable other than it becoming a contract by acceptance. And that is, if there's consideration provided by the offeree to the offeror, consideration to keep the offer open. And that's frequently referred to as a firm offer. But the firm offer is really an option. But in order to be an option at common law, it has to be supported by consideration. Interestingly enough, curiously enough, this set of rules about expiration of an offer changes when you have an option. That is, when the offer is supported by consideration. It's no longer true, for example, that any of these, well, of course, expire from old age doesn't apply as long as we're talking within the period of the option. Counteroffers and rejections do not permanently disable the offeree from accepting within the period of the option. Why? Well, because the theory goes, the reason why these result in the death of the offer is that the offeror can withdraw the offer at any time. But of course, once you've said, no, I don't want the offeror is not going to come back and say, oh, I withdraw the offer. Remember that same thing we talked about auctions. Why is it that the second from highest bidder cannot then have that bid accepted? It's because the court says, well, once there's been a higher bid, the lower bidder can safely assume that their offer has been rejected. Therefore, there's no reason for them to say, I withdraw my offer. Auctions are chaotic enough without that. Here, so in the case of just a bare offer, if you will, one not supported by consideration, it would be unfortunate rule that says the offeror, in order to avoid the offer being accepted by somebody who's already rejected it, has to respond to the rejection by withdrawing the offer. A little weird. However, this offeror is different because the offer is supported by consideration, and the courts say no. An option is an option. It's a contract. And if you say that the offeree has 30 days in which to exercise the option, they have 30 days to exercise the option. Now, what changes it is if the offeree, let's say on the 15th day, says to the offeror, I am not going to exercise the option. And the offeror now acts in reliance upon that. Let's say this was an offer to sell a particular good, and the option holder says, no, I'm not going to exercise my option. The offeror now offers that good to somebody else and sells it. At that point, it's too late. So reliance upon the rejection by the option holder will terminate the offer, but simply rejection will not. So let's look at Dickinson versus Dawes. One of the issues which we're going to confront over these next couple of hours is what happens when the offeror and the offeree are not in the same room, they're not face to face, or on the same telephone call. What happens? When is a communication effective? When is an offer an offer? When is it acceptance an acceptance? When is it rejection a rejection? When is a counteroffer a counteroffer? This is a little like the philosophic quest for information for the answer to the following question. If a tree falls in the forest and nobody is there to hear it, does it make a sound? Do we know enough about the nature of agreements here to be able to say, if we really take seriously the meeting of the minds, then communications have to be received in order to have any legal significance? Because if they're not received, how can they be an effect, how can they have an effect on the legal rights of the person who hasn't yet heard it? Now, you know, if I'm shouting across a distance, well, I have to worry only about the length of time that the sound takes to go from one side of the room to the other. But if I'm talking about communication in any other fashion, I do have to worry about it. Now, we're going to talk about it specifically with respect to the males. Talk briefly about that, but not today. Dickinson versus Dodds raises the following question. An offeror makes an offer. The offeror does not communicate to the offeree, and this offer has a period of time. It says you have until Friday 9 o'clock a.m., the 12th of June, 1874. And we're still within that time. And the offeree has decided to accept the offer. The offeror has been offering the property around to others. After all, that doesn't, at that point, talking to other people doesn't violate any contractual duty that they have at that point. They have to worry about the fact that they have an outstanding offer, though, and that they're obliged to the duties of a contract if the offeree accepts the offer before you revoke the offer or before the offer dies for some other reason. So what the seller was doing in offering it to others, or an other, is not in itself a violation of law. On the other hand, it obviously worried this particular offeree, and the offeree, you remember, rather frantically tries to communicate with the offeror, first going to the house of the mother of the offeror, where he had been staying, but he no longer lives there. Left the message, I accept, but that message never got to the offeror. Sends an agent to the railroad station where they find the offeror on that morning, the fatal 12th of June, at which point the offeror says, no, I've already sold it to somebody else. Well, maybe too bad for him, because it's been accepted, and it's been accepted within the period of time. What's the explanation that this court offers for why it is that, in fact, there's no contract here?
Because he was told prior to his acceptance that the offer was already off the table.
Okay. By whom was he told?
Whoever that Mr. Barry was in relation to.
Not by the offeror, though, right? Was it somebody who the offeror had designated as their agent to communicate to the offeree this information?
I believe so.
I don't think there's any evidence of that at all. One of the problems with this case is that there is some confusion here, at least in my mind, maybe not in the court's mind, about the exact timing of all this and what he knew and didn't know. So let's suppose that what he knew was that the offeror had been in serious conversations with another buyer. Could a seller be in serious conversations with another buyer in a way that would be consistent with the offer that's outstanding to this buyer? That's a business question I'm asking, not even a legal question. It's a business question. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, and what would the terms be then?
Well, they'd be the same,
they'd
be different.
Well, is he making an absolute promise to sell the property?
No.
Can he do that? To the second person?
It was just a general offer for whoever. There was no option saying that, you know, he withhold making any other.
Well, I understand that. So he's not violating the law, but he does have the following problem, doesn't he? That it's a single piece of property. It's not as though he had two of them, right? He only's got one. So either he sells it to A or he sells it to B. Now, if he's got an offer out to A for A to buy it, and he's talking to B, how must he discuss the sale in a way which will not end with his being obligated to deliver the same piece of property to both A and B?
Have the second one accepted before the first?
Well, that worked for him here, but it worked only because the court says, well, we think that that first offeree knew enough to have concluded that the offer had been withdrawn. If the court had not thought that, what would have happened to this guy? Who was the other defendant in this action? The other buyer, right? Yeah. And what kind of action was this? Yeah, well, that's called what? Specific performance. Good. This was an action of specific performance. Real property is unique, right? You get specific performance as your remedy. You remember that. So the reason why he joins as a defendant the other buyer is that the other buyer, in fact, by now has the property, or at least is laying claim to the property because he has a contract to buy it. The property can only belong to one person. The result of the specific performance action, if it had been successful, would be that the property belongs to this buyer. Well, not only does the other buyer not have the property, but what does he have? Does he have any claims? And against whom?
Yeah, wouldn't he have a claim against the original seller?
Of course. And what's the nature of his claim?
Breach of contract.
Breach of contract. It's a breach of contract. What's the breach? You promised me the property, you couldn't deliver it. That's a breach of contract. So you don't want to get involved in that. So you don't want to just, you know, be offering it the same way. I don't know. I would have thought that he might have been saying to this person, look, I have an outstanding offer. But he only has till Friday morning to accept. Are you interested in buying it if he does not accept the offer? Oh, then I'm clear. Then I've got everything I need. I can go through my negotiation. Sure, the guy has to wait until Friday morning to find out, but if he's a seriously interested buyer, he'll wait. And I don't get myself involved in the situation in which I have one piece of property and I'm contractually obligated to give it to two. Or, of course, I could have gone to my first offeree and said, I'm withdrawing that offer, even though it's before the period of time I said it would be open. That's still, you didn't pay me consideration for it. I can still withdraw it anytime I want. I withdraw the offer. And then you turn to your second buyer and say, I'll contract with you for the purchase. Now, the court helps him out a lot by saying, well, he really had heard enough. But when you look at the facts to see what he heard was that there were serious conversations going on about the sale of this property with this other buyer. Nowhere does the court say he knew that the property had been sold. Now, it is true that his behavior is a little frantic. And so it leads you to wonder what, in fact, he knew. And maybe the court suspected that he knew that, in fact, the property was now under contract with another buyer. But nobody, as far as we can tell, nobody knew that. Nobody said that expressly. It creates some interesting problems, but from the standpoint of the general proposition of law, apart from how it was applied here, what it stands for is this. Yes, it's true that in order to be effective, you have to communicate. So in order for a revocation of an offer to be effective as a revocation of an offer, it has to be communicated. But it doesn't have to be communicated by the offeror. It could be something that that the offeree learns indirectly. And that's the way this case is always read, as standing for that proposition. Whether correctly applied here or not is up to you. The court thought they were right. But the proposition of law is one which is widely accepted. Yes, communication is required. No, it doesn't have to be directly from the offeror. It can be, I don't know, in the atmosphere. Just something that you learn. Something that you learn from General Scuttlebutt. Okay. Question about that? Beginning to see a pattern here? Yes.
So it's not an invitation to deal. That's certainly not what the court could see. It was just an offer that the offer. He did not give him an invitation to deal. It was an actual
offer. No. It was an actual offer. The court says this is an offer, but on the other hand, the unavailability of the offer had been indirectly communicated to the offeree, and therefore, by the time the offeree accepted, they were accepting an offer that was no longer alive, was no longer available. It had become unavailable by this indirect communication to the offeree that the offeror had withdrawn the offer.
So they set aside the expiration.
That's right. The expiration didn't matter. That's why I said earlier, even though you say it'll be good until the 12th of June, on the 10th of June, you can change your mind and withdraw it. The only effect of saying until the 12th of June is that the offer won't die of old age, but it could be withdrawn, unless, of course, it's supported by expiration, in which case it's an option contract, and if you tried to withdraw it before the expiration of the option, that would be a breach of contract. A breach of the option contract.
So a contract like this, I'm just trying to make sense, doesn't have consideration, then that's why he could revoke it before he received the acceptance?
Yes.
Okay, and the options contract does have consideration.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm good now. You got it. If it doesn't have consideration, it's not an option contract. So the very words option contract mean that there is consideration.
Okay.
If we're using our language correctly. Otherwise, it is an offer. Or sometimes courts like to say a bare offer. Why is it bare? Because it's not clothed in consideration. Okay, let's look at Judge Peck, Supreme Court of Vermont. This is the case of Burgosta versus Wilder. But before we do that, since they cite you to the restatement section 45, let's talk about this section. As a background for understanding Section 45, first of all, one thing I should tell you that you should note, 45 is one half of what number?
90.
Don't ever forget that. It will help you remember Section 45. One half of 90, and you'll see the significance of that in 2 minutes. Okay. We know that many of the contracts we've talked about, not all, but most of them probably, are called, quote, bilateral contracts, by which we mean only that each side is making an offer. And when we talked about consideration, we said, yes, they're making an offer, but we look at the contents of the offer and see whether or not it involves some legal burden that they're undertaking as part of an exchange with the other party. But there is another way of making a contract, and that is for the offeror to make an offer, the response to which is an act. And when we talked about consideration, we actually saw that the formal definition of consideration and exchange involves the possibility of an offer on one side and an act on the other, just the same way as it could be an offer on one side, a promise on one side, and a promise on the other side. The language describing this is in the process of changing. And I'll undoubtedly slip back into the old nomenclature, and you probably will too, because it's convenient and easy to say, where it's an offer which asks for an act rather than asking for a promise. It used to be called a unilateral contract. Now the problem is that unilateral contract is like the sound of one hand clapping. You can't have a unilateral contract. It takes two, always. So the language is ill-suited. It really is. So the restatement, knowing that, the American Law Institute decided we're going to do something about this. We're going to have a correct description. So they came up with the following description: an offer which can only be accepted by an act. Well, that's good in descriptive terms, but it's a whole mouthful to say. And so it hasn't been very popular. But I'll try to use it because it really is much more descriptive of what we're talking about. There are certain offers which can only be accepted by an act, because it's what the offeror asks for. You can imagine this as a part of a conversation which you may have been engaged in yourself at some point or overheard, where somebody says, okay, you know, you really ought to go out. If you feel that way about it, you really ought to go out and give away your old clothes to Goodwill. And the response to this is, oh, I promise to do that. And the person who makes the original suggestion says, no, put your money where your mouth is. Right. Do it. Don't promise. Do it. That same notion of I'm not asking for a promise, I want you to do it, is what gives rise to this kind of an offer. It's not just happenstance. The offeror does not want a promise. The offeror wants action. And there's no reason in the eyes of the law for the offeror not to be able to cast the offer that way. Remember, the offeror is the master of the bargain. They decide what kind of bargain they want to enter into, including a bargain that says, no, I don't want a promise. So you say to yourself, well, if it's an offer which looks for an act, then what's the acceptance? And the answer is the acceptance is the act. But what's the performance? The performance is the act. The act that is asked for is both, at one and the same time, the acceptance and the performance. That's what makes it so peculiar in a way. Because when we think of contracts being formed by exchanges of promises, we can easily distinguish between these. Each one's making a promise. That's the one's the offeror, one's the offeree. And now we have a promise. And then, pursuant to the contract, each one has something to do, whatever it is they promise to do. Those are the performances. But in this one kind of contract, the performance and the acceptance are simultaneous. Well, you can imagine the problem that arises. So the classic is example, hypothetical is in the book as well. Okay, if you climb the flagpole, get to the top, I'll give you $50. You climb halfway up the flagpole. I say, I withdraw my offer. Well, how can I do that? Well, because the offer's not been accepted. What would be the acceptance? Reaching the top of the flagpole. Until you reach the top of the flagpole, you've not accepted, performed. Performed, accepted. And at any time before an offer is accepted, it can be withdrawn. We've already said that many times. This is very awkward. It left the lawyers who write the American Law Institute documents, the restatements, feeling as though something was decidedly wrong about the law. So they came up with Section 45. Now let's look at Section 45. Let's see what they did. This section and some others we're going to talk about are wonderful examples of why it is that the law is actually hard to do. That is, it's hard to create legal rules which will universally produce a just result. And here we're going to look at a part of the law that's not that complicated, and yet the American Law Institute and the courts have been struggling to figure out how to produce a just result from these circumstances. So along they come in 45 and say, option contract created by part performance or tender, where an offer invites an offeree to accept by rendering a performance and does not invite a promissory acceptance, so we know what we're talking about here. An option contract is created when the offeree tenders or begins the invited performance or tenders a beginning of it. Now let me ask you this. In the case of the flagpole, the person goes halfway up the flagpole. Have they begun the invited performance? Yeah, because I said if you climb the flagpole to the top, but you're climbing the flagpole but haven't reached the top. So you've begun performance, but you haven't yet accepted. That's this case. Notice what it does. It creates a what? An option contract. So what has the court done? In order to have an option contract, what do I need?
Consideration.
So what's the consideration?
The beginning of performance.
The American Law Institute says the beginning of performance is the consideration. That's a little weird. Is it the consideration for the contract? Can't be. What's the consideration for the contract?
The completion.
The completion. The completion. So what's its consideration for? What does it do? It's an option, and therefore...
It keeps the offer open.
Yes, it's enough consideration to keep the offer available. It's like the consideration that supports an option. It's not the consideration that supports the contract. That is the completion of the task. Because remember, the performance and acceptance occur simultaneously. Now, that sounds good. What if the offeror said, however, I will pay you $50 to be at the top of the flagpole. I will pay you $50 for you to be at the top of the flagpole. Now the court's going to have to decide, is climbing halfway the beginning of the invited performance? If so, an option contract is formed, and if not, nothing. Nothing. Some time ago, I gave the following on an examination. A landowner who decides that they would like a barbecue in their backyard goes to a mason and says, if you provide me with a barbecue in my backyard, I'll pay you $500. The mason goes to the brickyard and buys all the brick that would be required for the construction of the barbecue, puts it in the truck, brings the truck over to the owner's house, is about to unload, and the owner says, oh, I changed my mind. Has the mason begun performance? Or has the mason only prepared to begin performance? If all they've done is to prepare, then Section 45 is not applicable and there's no option. If what they've done is begun, so if I say to the mason, if you will go to the brickyard and buy enough brick for a barbecue for the backyard, I will pay you $500 for the barbecue on completion. Well, that's an offer which can only be accepted by performance, but going to the brickyard to buy the brick has now become the beginning of performance. That is, you can tell, you have to tell, the only way you can tell is from the offer how to distinguish the things which 45 requires us to distinguish, that is, the beginning of performance as opposed to a preparation to perform.
So, I'm sorry, so would like driving to the brickyard, would that equal preparation to perform?
Well, great question. If I say, if you go to the brickyard, then yes. But if I said, if you will buy at the brickyard the necessary brick, then driving to the brickyard is not the beginning of performance, but buying is. If I say, I'll pay you $500 for the barbecue in my backyard, then neither of those two is the beginning of performance.
But what, how can you build a barbecue with no brick? So what?
You can't. You can't. You can't. Nevertheless, I can assure you, I guarantee you, that no court will decide that as the beginning of performance unless the offeror described that as part of the performance. It is a necessary preparation to perform. It is reliance upon the promise. Well, if it's reliance, then maybe Section 90 should have a rule. Look at 87. Restatement of Contracts, Second, 87. 87. Three before 90. Two before 89. What chapter are we in? We're in the chapter which makes things enforceable in the absence of consideration. No consideration, but justice. An offer is binding as an option contract if it's in writing, signed by the offeror, recites a purported consideration for the making of the offer, proposed in exchange. All right, well, that sounds right. We know about those. That's no surprise. But look at 87.2. An offer which the offeror should reasonably expect to induce action or forbearance of a substantial character on the part of the offeree before acceptance, and which does induce such action or forbearance, is binding as an option contract to the extent necessary to avoid injustice. So we take the theme of Section 90 and we now apply it not to offers, not the promises, rather, but the offers. Now, I won't require that you read all the commentary, but I'll tell you that one of the things the commentary says, hey, but wait a second, if you do this, and it should be rarely used, but if you do this, it doesn't mean that there really is an option contract. What it really means is that it's enough of a contract so that any money spent in reliance by the offeree should be reimbursed, or at least it should be reimbursed on a restitutionary basis. Very cautious indication of what the scope of this should be. Nevertheless, in answer to your question. What 45 leaves undone, 87.2 tries to do. The difference is that 45, the beginning of performance really is an option. It really is consideration. It really does make it an option. It's an honest to God option. And the offeror cannot withdraw the offer, period. And he has to give the offeree a reasonable time to complete the performance. And then if the performance is completed, then obviously the offeror has got to do whatever the contract said he would do. But if it's preparation to perform and not the beginning of performance, then the best that the poor offeree can do is to cite 87.2, which may get them only, it may get them only a restitution or recovery if what they've done has benefited the offeror, or it may get them their expenses, their reliance expenses, maybe, but no more. It doesn't get them what 45 does, which is the offer is irrevocable and they get the finished performance and they get whatever the promisor promised. And if you think that isn't confusing enough, now I need you to turn back to a section that is right in between the two, and that's section 62 of the Restatement of Contracts. And this will give you a complete picture of a very muddled part of the law of contracts. Where an offer invites an offeree to choose between acceptance by promise and acceptance by performance, the tender or beginning of the invited performance, or a tender of a beginning of it, is an acceptance by performance. Hold on. What'd they say? If the offeror now makes an offer which is not clearly an offer which looks for performance as the only means of acceptance, the offer that they make could also be accepted by a promise, then the beginning of performance is a promise. Now, how does that differ from 45? They both make use of the beginning of performance phrase. What's the difference between the impact of 45 and the impact of 62?
Yeah. Well, under 62, if the offeree starts performance, the offeree is bound. Under 45, the offeree isn't bound until...
That's exactly right. Did you get that? Because 45, the result is that it's a true option contract. That is, that the offeror cannot withdraw the offer, but on the other hand, the offeree is not bound to do anything. If they wish to accept the offer, they of course have to complete the act. They have to complete their performance, that is their acceptance, and now, of course, they're entitled to whatever it is the promisor promised. But in 62, if the court thinks that, well, this promise could have been accepted by performance, but it could also have been accepted by promise, the result of beginning performance is that both sides are now completely bound. It's as though they had made a promissory acceptance. Well, you can imagine the problems. There are very few offerors which ever say in clear language, I am making the offer, and I want you to know that you can accept this offer either by performance or by promise. Now, if they do that, they're clearer than 62. But how about if it's a little vaguer than that? Then the court has to decide, does it fall within 45? That is, this is an offer which can only be accepted by performance. Or does it fall within 62? That is, it's an offer which can be accepted either by performance or by promise. In either case, of course, there has to be a beginning of performance. If there's no beginning of performance, then about all you can do for the offeror is to argue 87.2, in which case you will get, maybe, based upon reliance and if justice requires, you will get an option which may only mean that you're entitled to restitutionary or at most reliance damages. That's, of course, far less than 45 gives you, because 45 is going to give you expectation damages if you perform the act. And indeed, 62 is also going to give you expectation damages, and you must complete the act. The difference, as you correctly say, is in 45, if you don't complete the act, you haven't breached. Section 62, if you haven't complete, if the offeree does not complete the action they have breached, because their beginning of performance is tantamount to a promissory acceptance. Okay, we will now, but not tonight, obviously, pick up the Gosta versus Wilder, and we'll see how all this applies. And then we're going to move on to Drennan versus Starkey. Stay with the assignments as they are.